Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. I don't want anybody to think otherwise. If they don't have the authority to spend the money, then the money they spent was fraudulent. Therefore, the debt they took to spend that money is equally fraudulent. So, in our appeal to heaven, we're still learning, praying, and acting. And let me just emphasize today that when we get up off of our knees or when we end and conclude our prayer, I'm hoping that everybody agrees with me that we need to, you know, move forward as if the whole world is depending on us. Because it is. So, as agents for him, we all need to understand that it's all riding on us. We have to do this. And it is all about, and this is how easy it is. Hey, that's not constitutional. You don't have the authority to do that. You have to stop doing that. Holding every public servant accountable to those very few powers delegated. So with all of that, welcome back, Tammy. Welcome back, Sean. And we were actually just diving into Article 5. And Sean made a quick comment, and I wanted to expound on that. God bless Article 5. What did that mean?
Well, to me, it means that I live in Louisiana, and they change the Constitution like every couple of years to suit whatever they're trying to accomplish in their agenda of power. Mm-hmm. And I think if it wasn't for Article 5, we wouldn't even be able to have this conversation because they would have destroyed their original Constitution. There is no telling what we'd be dealing with now.
Well, so this nation, I like to point out to people that this nation was established by very educated and civil men. They didn't have any toleration. As a matter of fact, I think it kind of goes in hand with Christian faith that, you know, sin is wrong and you got to live right. And so they created a very limited government. They wanted to keep government confined that way. And it took a long time for things to really start changing and to really start deviating away from that, where godlessness became the rule of the day. And shoot, that was like 150 years later, almost, when godlessness became the rule of the day, because that was in the 1920s, and technically in 1776 to 1920s, it's about 150 years. Anyway, as we look at what they created, I mean, Madison, in the ratification debates, was talking to, I think, Grayson, Delegate Grayson, I forget his first name, but he was an anti-federalist, and he wanted to know, you know, at what point would they need to have the militia instead of the sheriff, you know, engaged in, in the problem, you know, like a civil unrest or what have you. And Madison basically said, I think that there could be a riot that could easily get out of hand where the sheriff would not have enough people to actually quell the riot, that he would need the state militia to step in to support him. And what that means is they're not talking about a riot like, you know, the the volunteers just won the Super Bowl, right? I mean, where they're going to just tear the town down, right? Because that's what we see today. Uncivil behavior was usually uncivil behavior because people were up at arms with their government. They created, they already had a system of First Amendment petitions for the redress of grievances. But at that point in time in the Constitution, it wasn't the First Amendment. It was the right of petition. The right of petition was integrated into Continental Congress. It was a part of the law of the land. It was integrated into every state. And so everybody understood that you getting out and you grabbing a torch, you know, and your hoe or a shovel or some implement of destruction and an axe over your shoulder and start marching downtown, that is not acceptable behavior. And this is one of the reasons why, think about this, folks, every state, every city has laws regarding the restriction or the blocking of commerce. You're going to work. You're traveling from your home to a place of business or to your, you know, your store, whatever it is. In so doing, you're engaging in an act of commerce to provide for your family, which is, this is, these are inalienable rights. An act of commerce is an inalienable right because we all have to be able to do something to survive. You know, we may live off of your property and live off the land, but we wanted to make sure that everybody had the right of a throughfare to be able to, conduct commerce. You're growing food, you need to sell some of that food. They wanted to make sure that the flow of commerce would never be restricted. So they created laws that say you cannot block commerce. And technically, when somebody actually has a breakdown on a road and they're blocking, as a matter of fact, I know out here in Washington, if you're driving a tractor and there is, I think if you have seven cars, you're driving down the road and there's seven cars that get, you know, backed up behind you because you can only drive so fast in a tractor, then you have to pull off at the next opportunity, the driveway or what have you, to allow the cars to pass, and then you can get back on the road because you're blocking, impeding traffic, impeding commerce. So when you look at these protesters that are going out and blocking walkways, they're blocking streets, they're blocking blocks of city government area, or I should say city commerce areas and what have you, how are these people being empowered to do the right thing when our framers clearly said that your inalienable rights are protected? Well, you're not happy with your government? You don't have a right to block others and take away their rights. Your right is to get into City Hall and stand up and say, we want these grievances redressed. Now, so here's the sneaky thing that the courts did. Because they knew the communist movement is not a legitimate redress of grievances. It's a demand of giving them something that you don't have the authority to give them, right? Does that make sense, Tammy and Sean?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Tammy, y'all with me on this? So when we look at, you know, Antifa demanding, social justice, taking from people their property so that you can give it to others, that is something that's a direct violation of the Constitution, right? Now, Tammy, there's a good chance you
right.
might...
Sorry, I was on mute.
So you're probably yelling at me and going, anyway. All right, so now it's official. Tammy's with us. So, okay. So when we look at telling these people that they need to go to City Hall, then they would be outed. I wanted everybody to understand this. The judges knew that when somebody stood up and said, hey, you need to take from these people and give it to us. You need to give us more money for our lack of production in flipping burgers, for entry-level jobs. We need a life living wage. All of these communist ideas will not fly when you're basically asking government to redress them, because what you're asking for, they have no power to give you. Ah, but if they enable you to get out into the market square to where you could start scaring people and basically invoking fear, because eventually anarchy will break loose. When people want, then they start doing things. And this was a part of the counterculture revolution. This was a part of the Bolshevik Revolution in America. Now, in Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution took 60 years, folks. I haven't said this in a long time, but when the Tsar freed the slaves in the 1860s, there were 20-some million slaves and serfs that were instantly freed in Russia, which means that they were no longer bound to the land. They were no longer slaves. Now they could go anywhere, but there was no place to go. And as a matter of fact, because they were freed, they didn't want to work for the guy. They may have wanted to work for the people because they were nice, because that happened. But for the most part, these people wanted to move, but there was nowhere to go. He basically put 20-some million people in a situation where they were going to die. Because at least as a serf and as a slave, they had a roof over their head and they had food coming. Now they have no property. They have no way of being, you know, they don't even have seeds to grow food. So this really created a huge problem. And so by the 1860s, guess what book had been published? Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto. And so what they did was they started creating communes. And just like the French communes of the 1790s, or the 1700s, late 1700s, they created communes. They started living and pooling together and working together, and they started educating themselves and using the language of Marx, you know, regarding this brewing of the Bolshevik Revolution. That happened in 1860. And look at how long it took for it to break out. When did the Bolshevik Revolution really kick off, where there were shots fired, things were being, you know, burnt down, damaged, people were being hurt, killed, what have you? When did that really happen?
1917.
What?
Was it 1917?
1917. So that's basically almost 70 years, right? Or 60 years. Almost 60 years later. Almost. Actually, no, it's basically 50 years. So regardless, it's just over a half a century. And it took how long for the Bolshevik Revolution to fully take, where they finally had Lenin there to, you know, take him over the finish line? It was, what, 1920-something? So as you're looking that up, the reality is this. In America, when did our Bolshevik Revolution really begin?
In the 60s. No, 1913.
1913 is when the Bolshevik Revolution started, and it ended in 1917?
No, I was commenting about ours.
Oh, ours in 1913. So, actually, no. So, a Bolshevik Revolution is where you have enough people convinced that they need to take over their government and, you know, basically move their government model to a communist, a communal, because communism, communal, same, where everybody is going to live, you know, and create a statist government. So technically, when you look at the 1950s and the 1960s, that counterculture revolution, you know why they never called that the Bolshevik Revolution? Because the majority of the people weren't convinced at that point. In other words, they just started the communes, right? If you look at the counterculture revolution, this is when communes were actually being applied in America, where people were coming together and working together, and they were realizing that historically, the tragedy of the commons will always occur. Do you know what the tragedy of the commons is? And if you do, can you tell us? Okay. So the tragedy,
what was it again?
The tragedy of the commons. This is a term that was given the pilgrims going into Massachusetts. So the pilgrims, in going into Massachusetts, they created a communal system where everybody worked together and they would all share the harvest equally. Well, the tragedy of the commons is when it came time to harvest, there were some people that didn't think that there was enough on those vines and, you know, in those fields to feed everybody. So they said, we need more. So in the middle of the night, they would go and help themselves. So when people went out there to harvest, on the day of harvest, half the crop was gone. And many people died because they didn't have enough to subsist on. And so you could probably figure out by the end of the winter, you know, those people who stole it, and you could say, oh, because you survived, because you look healthy still compared to everybody else.
Right.
Anyway, I'm sure they had some of those conversations, but that happened for a couple of years, and that was called the tragedy of the commons, because people, everybody has their own interests. There's this acronym we call WIFM. Does anybody know what WIFM means? What's in it for me? That's a WIFM. What's in it for me? Because everybody is self-serving. Even a communist is self-serving. If a communist, if you're a true diehard communist and you have a car, you would not lock that car up and you would not, you know, take the key. You'd leave that car accessible for anybody and everybody because it's not your car. You don't own property. A true communist doesn't exist. That's the whole point. Go ahead.
So it sounds like they used the tragedy of the commons to to argue that resources need to be regulated.
Or where the community, you know, would manage themselves to say, you know, because this is where the church came in. See, what they did, they were all, it was kind of like a theocracy, right? When you look at Massachusetts, mm-hmm. it was the Puritans as well as the heathens, because there were a group of heathens with them that ended up becoming integrated and kind of tarnishing the Puritans over time. But, you know, because they were always challenging, you know, you kind of knew, oh, that, you know, that person's not a real Puritan. They were part of the heathens when they came here. Because you know that that kind of stuff happens, right? You know, the Hatfields and McCoys. Everybody knows, you know, that child is, you know, three-quarters Hatfields, and that child over there is two-thirds McCoy, you know, because you're talking a century after the real, you know, the real breakup of the Hatfields and McCoys, and how there's been this, you know, crossbreeding, whatever you want to call it, where, you know, you got family on both sides, but everybody knows who's what. So anyway, because they were divided when they got there, and the Puritans actually took over. And so the heathens, because they were not as many, they were basically controlled by the Puritans. Well, I think it was probably the heathens that probably violated that created the tragedy of the commons. But what ended up happening was they basically said, every person for themselves, you're going to have your own land, and everybody's going to have their own parcel, and you produce for yourself. So if you want to be indolent and not do anything, then it'll be left up to us. But we have the church. If you need assistance, so the church would step in if all of a sudden, for some, you know, an act of God, a lightning bolt burnt your house down, your food and everything else, and you're going into winter with nothing, then the people of the community and the church would help you. So that nobody was left out in the cold, but that was the job and responsibility of the community and the church. So when we looked at government's involvement in America, the one thing that actually made America great was their spirit of Christianity, where they believed compassionate services was not to be done by government. The compassionate services needed to be provided by the churches and the community, where you could, you know, the good women of the community making quilts and what have you, make sure every kid has a nice warm blanket. Because back in those days, they didn't have glass for windows, right? There were just holes or whatever. So anyway, I don't hate to go down this long rat hole, but the point is that the American Revolution has, the Bolshevik Revolution has literally started in America. It's taken this long to convince enough people. And it wasn't done by, you know, sitting in communes. They had to start creating the communes in the education system, which when they took over the education system, it was after the 1950s and 60s. Even though, to be clear, the Fabians took over our education system in the 1880s, where they started changing the content slightly, and they started driving, like evolution in the 1920s, they started driving sex education in the 1940s. And all of these things, every time they came to, we're going to do this because it's going to solve this unwanted pregnancies. And actually, with sex education, unwanted pregnancies went through the roof. And when they came out with, oh, we're going to give people welfare so that we can, you know, make sure everybody can, you know, go to work and take care of themselves. It's just a boost up, right? It's just a hand up. Well, when they started, you know, putting welfare out there, it started going viral or wild or what have you, because they weaponized it. They actually started giving mothers more welfare if she didn't have a father in the home. For every child she had without a father in the home, she got more money. Well, guess what? My sister, who was in school in the 60s when this game had begun, my sister came back to my folks and said, you know, if I start having babies, I can start making money from the government without a father. Yep. And so everybody started to realize what a game this is. You know, and
if you live in California, even better.
And the concept of what's in it for me goes wild. Does that make sense? Because the government's providing all these different fruits out there that are all evil. They're all going to destroy us. And everybody started helping themselves, whether it was the farmers taking subsidies for not growing food. So the farmers didn't realize what was coming around the corner. What was coming around the corner was because they weren't using their equipment, because they weren't working their land, and because they were just used to getting subsidies, that when it came time where the subsidies gone, and now they've got a 15, 20-year-old tractor that's got problems. Now they have a hard time actually getting their farm kicked in again. And this is when we saw in the 80s farm relief starting to kick in, you know, concerts for the farming, trying to save America's farming. Remember that? Sean, you probably remember that.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay. So, because I don't know if you're old enough, Tammy, back in the 80s with some of those concerts.
I was about 10 or 9.
Oh, okay. All right. So we started seeing how the poison, everything the government was giving us in social engineering and social services was evil. And so as slowly as they started taking us down this path, they had to take more and more and more from the people in the education system so that they would literally have what I would call the petri dish of society finally ready to actually create true communists, which is why we have a homeless problem, which is why we have all the problems we have because of our education system. When you look right now, if you go to the river of society, look right now from the banks into the river, we see nothing but refuse and problems. It's just filth. It's terrible. But these things just didn't happen right here at the bank. You have to go way upstream to find the source of the problem. And the source of the problem has literally been our education system and those things being controlled by government, because government is putting this crap in the water. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to deal with the homelessness, you know, all those people that don't have a home. No, we got to stop the problem upstream. We'll never get on top of this until we do. That's an old world way of thinking. Most people just react to the problem because that's the symptom of the real problem, right? Homelessness is the problem, but actually it's a symptom of the problem. So anyway, forgive me. We're actually, I've wasted the whole show because we've dove into this. But when we come back, we're going to go into Article 5. And Tammy, just to catch up, Sean had already read basically the most of the first part into the orange. And they did not, and so we kind of covered this, but I think we need to read it again so we can, when we come back, we'll read it again so that the people listening today have the context of it so that we can kind of go through that. But the most important part of Article 5, folks, is not truly the amendment or the convention part. It's the very last part of Article 5, which are the amendment protections. I want to explain this. The amendment protections, in other words, there are two clauses in the amendment protection clause, or there's two parts to it, that say that there can be no amendment passed that will do these things. In other words, when you really look at the two most contentious issues of the Constitutional Convention, slavery and state sovereignty, in other words, the states to be protected from the federal government, so that the federal government couldn't mess with them, couldn't take away their suffrage in their Senate and respect their sovereignty so that they could continue being the culture and the state that they were. This all speaks to the fact that the federal government was never created to homogenize America. They were created to be able to adapt to the needs of each of the states in their legal systems, and that was it. They were there to support the states and how they wanted to govern themselves, not to force them into the democracy that the federal government or the Warren Court wanted. So we'll get into that, and then we'll actually, we'll also, once we cover this in the Amendment Protection Clause, I sent both Tammy and Sean the Washington State Constitution. So when we're done with that, then I want to dive into that to get back into representation and the spirit of representation at the county level and so forth, the way it was done in Washington, like the federal system, so that we kind of get a good glimpse of this. But anyway, we'll be right back after this short promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so Tammy and Sean, let's go ahead and dive into Article 5 real quick so that we can kind of identify the two paths. We already did this yesterday. There are two separate paths of amending or changing, wholesale rewriting the Constitution. Actually, technically, Congress cannot rewrite the Constitution. They can only make amendments to it. But the states can, if in a convention, they can rewrite it. It's the only mechanism, the only way, or the only path where the Constitution is in jeopardy of completely its own demise in a rewriting by those attending the delegation. One of the things I mentioned yesterday at the end of the show was, Tammy, is Article 5 in the Constitution? I mean, this is a stupid question, but I'm asking it because we've covered jurisdiction. And so you're going to say yes, right?
Yep.
It's right there. So it's in the Constitution. When you get to Article 5, there it is. That's Article 5. And that means that it arises under this Constitution, which means that the federal court has jurisdiction over any controversy or any issue regarding Article 5. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the John Birchers and the Convention of State folks have failed to let you know that if they actually convene a convention, there's a good likelihood that Congress will come along and try to regulate them, because what has Congress not taken under their wing to control and regulate? I mean, they've taken life, you're taking your timber, they're taking your food, they're even taking your air by spraying you with chemtrails. The point is that what would make us think, because there's nothing under the sun that they haven't tried to control. So the day you create this convention, I mean, this would be the opportunity of a lifetime for Congress to step in and say, we're going to tell you how you're going to do this convention. And Congress will probably try to inflict a democracy instead of delegation, sort of breaking the decorum of the previous convention of 1789 and forcing a democracy where it's representative and so forth and so on, which is, I mean, it'd be absolutely the abomination. And what would end up happening is the states say, no, you can't do that, you can't do that, and they'll go to the Supreme Court, and guess what? The Supreme Court will rule however they want to rule, and 9 times out of 10, the way the Supreme Court rules is always at a disadvantage of the states. Always. Very rarely have they done the right thing. And so,
whiff them.
Go ahead. What did you say, Sean?
I was just saying, whiff them.
Yeah, whiff them.
What's in it for me?
There you go. Thank you.
That's exactly what Congress would do.
And Congress would do that, and the Supreme Court would do that. Because, right. You know, how come this, we can use this to our advantage? Why not? Yeah, anyway, okay. So because Sean read this, I'll let you go ahead and read this, because it'll start off with the congressional path where Congress can create an amendment and send it out with 2/3, and then, or the states, by 2/3 requesting a convention, can create a convention and create amendments, and then, you know, they can send it out, and they go through the ratification process. And that's kind of where we left off. So go ahead and pick that up, and that'll take us through the orange of Article 5.
Okay. The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which, in either case, you want me to keep going?
Yes, yes, go all the way through the orange. Yeah, okay. All the way through the orange.
Oh, okay. Which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states or by conventions and three-fourths thereof as the one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress.
So in other words, right here in Article 5, most people didn't realize that in the amendment, they can actually, Congress can actually identify, or the convention can identify, that this amendment or change can be ratified by either the state legislature or by a mode of a convention. In other words, the counties would select delegates like the Constitutional Convention and go to a state convention to determine whether they ratify it or not, which would then empower the separate process. So that's pretty much what they have. Now, what we're talking about, what I basically said, is everything that starts with the provided that no amendment which shall be made, that's all in red and yellow, red background, yellow text, provided that no amendment which shall be made. Folks, that's putting the gauntlet down. That is saying you shall not pass any amendment that will do these things, and there's two. So, Sean, go ahead and read the first one, and it ends with the ninth section of the first article. Go ahead.
Provided that no amendment which may be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of the first article.
Okay, so what that is they wanted to make sure that there would be no amendment to the Constitution that keep Congress from being able to regulate the importation of persons. That's exactly what that part is in Article 1, Section 9. That is the regulation, and technically, it is the ability for the federal government to shut down the slave trade. Okay? Not mincing any words here. The federal government and the convention actually put this language in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 9, that Congress in 1808 would have this power to regulate and shut down that importation of persons, or i.e. very specifically, slaves. Therefore, there's no amendment that could be created that would stop Congress's ability in 1808 to do that. Now, Tammy, read the last one.
And that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate.
So right there, we see the two factions, or I should say, the two biggest bones to pick in the Constitutional Convention surface. They wanted to make sure that there was no way that the states would lose their equal suffrage in the Senate, which means because the Senate was where the states could protect their sovereignty in this government. Now, everybody thinks that the 17th Amendment did that. Now, if the 17th Amendment took away the state suffrage of the Senate without their consent, the state suffrage within the Senate, their equal suffrage in the Senate, without their consent, then wouldn't that be a violation of this line right here?
Absolutely. So they can't, it would be null and void. Because it already says you can't do that.
Which is the beautiful thing about the 17th Amendment, because it doesn't even say that at all. All the 17th Amendment does is it changes the method of how senators are to be chosen and how they're to be replaced. It didn't touch any of their responsibilities or who they were to represent. That's all the 17th Amendment did. So here becomes the huge question. Why are the states not getting their equal suffrage in the Senate? It's not like there's any mechanism in the amendment or anything at all in this Constitution that says you cannot demand your suffrage. You have lost your ability to have your equal suffrage in the Senate. Why? And this goes back to, we talked about this, Sean, when we kind of pointed out that, you know, how my article literally would have kept the federal government from being shut down. If all of the states actually took control of their senators and said, you're going to vote this way, and we counted this, and I proved this, that Arizona, those two Democrats that voted for Arizona to basically, you know, be shut down, then that they wouldn't have voted that way, because Arizona would have removed them when they voted that way, because they would have had full control over them and say, we're telling you how to vote. You don't have a choice. You don't. A senator is, there's nowhere in the Constitution where a senator is given full license to vote their conscience. This is a Republican form of government, and they represent very specific constituents. When those constituents demand that you vote a certain way, and in the old days, there was this honor thing that if you voted against that, well, the only thing they could do is to try to make sure that they didn't select you in, you know, in the next run. Oh, well, crap. Now that they don't select their senators, you're being voted in by the people, so the senators believe that they're immune. Ah, but in the new days, and actually the new days began before the 17th Amendment, the new days, what I call the new age of accountability in our Constitution, is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So technically, any senator that fails to support their oath of office, to support this Constitution, and to fulfill that obligation in supporting it, means that if they were told how to vote, and they're told right here that they cannot deprive the state its equal suffrage in the Senate, and they choose not to vote that way, then they've literally violated their oath, correct?
No person shall.
That's right. So what we have here, folks, is we've been duped, and the states have been duped because of our illiteracy on the Constitution. If a Nimrod like myself gets this stuff, then, and I have to go over it and over and over, maybe because I'm a Nimrod, I just don't explain it well. I bet there's going to be somebody that's going to come along and go, wow, he's right, and they'll explain it far better and far more eloquently, you know, more concise, what have you. But it doesn't matter. I'm right on this. As a matter of fact, all of the academic proof proves that this right here, the state legislature, this was the whole part of the Constitutional Convention, that was their suffrage in the Senate. When they said the state, they were just, instead of having to say state legislature every time, they just said state. Because everybody knew that the Senate was voting for that state legislature, and everybody knew that the House of Representatives was representing their people in the congressional district. What happened? And I'm here to tell you, folks, when you look at Georgia, two Democrats in Georgia voted to shut down the government. That's four votes right there. And then there's these other votes. There's Pennsylvania, they've got Fetterman. And there was one, I think there's another one. We went through this, Sean, but when we actually went through everything, there was more than enough votes if the states would have actually taken control and said, you will vote this way. You will not shut down this government. Well,
yeah, it wouldn't have happened.
It wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened. And as a matter of fact, the people you need to get pissed off at is not the Senate. You need to get pissed off at your state legislature. Because they're not
holding them accountable.
There you go. Thank you, folks. We have to hold our county legislators accountable, who have to hold our state legislators accountable, so that they will hold the federal legislators accountable. It's, you know, it's that old saying, you know, something falls downhill. Well, we're at the top of this hill. We're at the top of the heap, folks. So who's really at fault for allowing all of this stuff to go south or sideways?
We are. Yes,
there we go. We the people basically have the majority of the blood on our hands. So, okay. All right, now we kind of covered this.
That means we can fix it too, so
that's right.
The good side of it.
That's right. You know, I guess my short-term memory is failing me, but was there something else I wanted to cover? Oh, yeah. So I actually went out, because we were talking about representation and diving into this, so I actually went out and created a table of representation of the original states. And if I went to New York and I just paralleled Georgia and I highlighted New York versus Georgia on representation, and I'm basically going to tell you folks that in the first apportionment of New York, they had 6 representatives. In the second apportionment of New York, that was the 1700 to 1800, the second apportionment, then they went to 17. So in 1803, actually in 1803 they went to 17. They went from 6 to 10 and then to 17 and then to 27. Georgia, because it's a plantation state, look at how representation grew the first 4 censuses. It went from 3 down to 2. The new census, they lost a representative. And then in 1800, they went up to 4. And in 1810, they went to 6. Now, when you look at from 6 to 27, that's more than 400% increase in New York. And it's only 100, actually, it's not even 100%. They went to 3 to, okay, 3 to 6, that is 100%. My bad. So in other words, New York was 4 times increased in representation because they didn't have the slave 3/5 rule and the locking down of the state property for plantations. Tammy, we've worked together for a long time. You've heard me say this, right? How the way the Constitution was written, it was going to obsolete slavery. So if I go to the next state, which is North Carolina, North Carolina was another hardcore slave state. And I'm just going to match it to New York because New York was obviously an abolition state. North Carolina started off with 5, and in the first one they went to 10, then they went to 12. So they actually grew in the first apportionment from 5, which was in the Constitution, to the first census they got 10. So they grew from the very first census. The first census is when the accurate population was finally counted. So the very first thing, that very first number doesn't mean much because it was a guess. So they went from 10 to 12 in 1800, where New York went from 10 to 17. And then in the next one, in 1810, they went from 12, North Carolina went from 12 to 13. They gained 1. Where New York went from 10 to 17, and then 17 to 27, where North Carolina only gained 1 again. So in other words, North Carolina was not growing in population nearly as New York was. I could look at Massachusetts, and Massachusetts went from 8 to 14, you know, from the initial Constitution. So the accurate one was 14. Then they went to 17. Then they went to 20. So when North Carolina finally jumped to 13, Massachusetts went to 20. So my point is that when we really look at slavery, it inhibits the growth of the state. And if had they locked slavery down to basically force the states to decide what they were going to do, Missouri would not have become a slave state. It was literally going to break that paradigm, and all those people that invested heavily in their plantation, you know, growth into Missouri, they were going to lose. They were going to lose their ability to have slaves. So we actually saw how the Constitution, the fruit of the Constitution, was bearing. And so had we broken this down even further, and we actually eliminated, because I believe most all the states that joined, because all these other states that were joining that were south of the Mason-Dixon line, that was being inflicted upon them. Now, I believe Mississippi and Alabama, and I even believe Louisiana, that was just the, you know, you couldn't stop that. But there's no doubt in my mind, I do not believe that Texas would have wanted to be a slave state when Texas joined the Union. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's interesting when you actually look at the facts and you actually lay it out there. And I need to do a little bit more color coding with this, but I just got this data. I just pulled it in and said, well, let's take a look at this. And it's no surprise to me that we were seeing how the House of Representatives was really becoming more abolition movement than the Senate. Why? Because the Senate had equal suffrage. This is where they were protected. Their slavery was being protected in the Senate. So it was incumbent to bring in more states and more states to finally get the Senate to actually get to that two-thirds. Now, if we actually, you know, if we did not allow the Missouri Compromise and the infliction of slavery, and we allowed those states, I just make the guess that all those states, Arkansas, as well as Texas, as well as, you know, Kansas, and all these other states that were probably on the south side of the Mason-Dixon line, they would not have been slave states, period. And I believe that what would have ended up happening was the slavery would have been ended well before the Civil War, well before it, by an amendment that would have been forced out, where you would have had, I think, enough states to actually vote to end slavery. State legislatures, what have you. But anyway, go ahead.
That was the question I was going to ask on that issue. Would the state were the senators actually representing the state legislatures at that time?
Yes. So absolutely, they were. And as a matter of fact, they didn't have real, so you've heard me say this, at least the people on the show have heard me say this all the time. Today, we have real-time governing. You know, we actually can talk instantly, thousands of miles away, have a direct conversation. We can watch the video of hearing what somebody's saying thousands of miles away, so we can really engage quickly. Hey, shut your pie hole. Right? You can't say that. That you're not representing us. That does not represent us. And we have real-time governing. We can actually reach out and call that person. As a matter of fact, I would bet today that the senators would have a very special phone that would be only available to the state legislature, that when the state legislature rang that phone, they better pick up or they better just start packing because they're coming home.
Right. Pick up or pack.
I'm telling you, folks, when people understand the power that they have and this right of suffrage, what's in it for them? Everything. Everything is in it for the states. The Constitution did it that way. The Constitution was not created to protect the globalists in stealing this government away from us. This, again, is the next, I think, the shining light from a different angle on, you know, seeing his DNA in this Constitution. When we go back, I actually didn't say this on Article 4, but I've said this a lot. And, you know, for Sean's benefit, Article 4, Section 3, in admitting states into the Union, there's nowhere there that it says that only states in the Northwest or in the Northern Hemisphere could be admitted into the Union. Any state could actually come and become a state in the Union, which means go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just saying like Canada.
Canada, as a matter of fact, Canada was sought to join the Union, and we went to Mexico. And both those nations, at that point in time, because we had slavery, they said, we don't want to have anything to do with you. Both nations did not, they looked down upon slavery. And so that nationalism, slavery and nationalism, became a very bad paradigm to break. Especially when they protected it with these unconstitutional things like the Missouri Compromise. So, you know, Article 4 in admitting states into the Union, you can see that's his plan in creating a global government. So let's cover Article 6, because Article 6 is literally the message to the world how the Constitution, or this Constitution, was not going to undermine anything that was already done before. So go ahead, and Sean, if you want to read that first clause or the first two lines of Article 6.
Do you think I could get a go back on something real quick?
No.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on this.
I said no. I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
On Article 4, where it says, or no, 5, where it says the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of the first article.
Uh-huh.
So what about the fourth clause?
Uh-huh. What about the fourth clause? So you have to break down all the clauses, right?
Apportionment of the taxes.
Yeah, so no capitation. Right. Okay. And so that right there, that is, so it's in purple, right? There's no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid. That right there was only laid on slaves coming into the United States. If you go into Article 1, Section 1, it talks about, or actually, if it's Article 1, Section 9, subsection 1, it basically says, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation. And then it says here, no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration here herein directed to be taken. In other words, they're pointing to that first section that says, hey, you know, every slave that comes in will be taxed up to $10, not exceeding. So that was a part of that slave trade as well. Because they were allowing the slaves to be made, or the slaves to be brought in. And so the federal government, or I should say the convention, said, we want to have a tax. We're going to put a capitation tax on every slave. And that way, you know, it puts money into the coffers for the federal government. They didn't like that, but they said, what do you want? You want everything? You're not going to get everything. You give us something, or you don't get anything. So there you go. Those were the compromise. That's all about compromise, right? And compromise is always, basically the fast road to taking away somebody's liberty. But let's go back to 6, and let's look at that very first clause, that all debts contracted and so forth. And that would be you, Sean. Go ahead.
Article 6. All debts contracted and engagements entered into before the adoption of the Constitution shall be as valid against the United States under this Constitution as under the Confederation.
Okay, so in other words, those things that the Confederation actually executed with foreign entities, we talked about this several times, and this is that clause that ties to that the debt that was created, the war debt, that Continental Congress had the power to do, then I think Microsoft just reminded me of something. So this war debt was one of those things that was hard committed, and the United States, this new government, was committed to paying those debts and those engagements. Those trade agreements that they actually went into that was actually in force, or whatever they were, those types of treaties, you know, such as the treaty with Britain of giving us the Northwest Territory, all those types of things were basically incorporated if it was in association or in a direct relationship to a foreign treaty, foreign debt, what have you. Everything else that was domestic was basically superseded by the Constitution, like the Northwest Ordinance admitting states into the Union. The Constitution superseded that. So anyway, well, we're out of time, and that's how it goes. So we'll be back. And actually, folks, there's no reason why tomorrow we won't actually finish Article 6 and Article 7 and actually get ready to start the Bill of Rights, if not starting the Bill of Rights, possibly tomorrow. And that way we're kind of looking at the last throes of the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.